Good morning. This is First Things, brought to you by Jackson's First Presbyterian Church. The minister of the First Presbyterian Church is Dr. Ligon Duncan. Stay tuned for First Things. And now here with First Things is Dr. Ligon Duncan.
Thank you, Bill Wyman. This is Ligon Duncan, and I'm hosting First Things again on my own today. We have missed Derek Thomas the last couple of weeks, but he'll be back with us when we return again. But we're continuing a conversation that we started last week with Dr. Gene Edward Veith. Dr. Veith is the former dean of the School of Arts and Sciences and associate professor of English at Concordia University in Wisconsin. He has been for a number of years the cultural editor of World Magazine, and many of you read him regularly through the auspices of World Magazine. Now he is the full-time cultural editor of World Magazine, and he is the director of the Chronic Institute, that is C-R-A-N-A-C-H, that is now based out of Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne. But Ed is still in Wisconsin, where the last time we talked, he told us it was 9 degrees. Good morning and welcome to First Things, Ed.
Good morning.
We're delighted to have you here. We had a wonderful conversation about the doctrine of vocation and the importance of having a Christian view of what it is to serve our neighbor and to glorify God in serving our neighbor in all of life last week. And I do want to remind folks who didn't hear that conversation, Ed's book, God at Work, Your Christian Vocation in All of Life. Gene Edward Veith, Jr. is the author. It's published by Crossway Books. It would be a wonderful entry point for thinking Christianly about our vocations. But this week I want to tackle a different subject, a subject that that Ed has tackled in writing. You, as an English professor, have no doubt been encountering postmodernism for many years, and you've written a book called Postmodern Times, A Christian Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture, which is published by, again, Crossway Books. Tell folks, let's say there's somebody on the way to preach out in Morton, Mississippi, or Newton, or Kosciuszko, or Ackerman today, and they're listening to First Things, and they've heard people talk about postmodernism, but if they had a gun held to their head and told that they had to give a two-sentence definition of it, they'd be in big trouble. Tell us what in the world we're talking about when we talk about postmodernism.
Well, I found a lot of people like that. I talked to a pastor's group out in Alaska, and they said they have a parishioner out in the Arctic Circle by himself, totally cut off from everything, and yet they are the most postmodernist people they've ever heard of, and they don't even know why. Because even people who don't know what it is have often soaked it up from somewhere. Postmodernism... Well, let me start with modernism.
Good.
Modernism was built on the age of reason. That science would solve all of our problems, that if we can just figure it out, if we can just prove everything. It's the view that was through most of the 20th century, but goes back to the Enlightenment, that rejected Christianity because you can't prove it and because it's not rational and everything has to be scientific. Well, that was a worldview that we had to deal with. The interesting thing is now in the 21st century, beginning a few decades before that, that view has become passé. The postmodernist says this: there is no objective truth. Truth is something we construct for ourselves. Truth isn't a discovery. The truth is out there, and we have to find out what it is, whether by reason, or Christians would agree that reason is a good way, but we also believe in revelation and other kinds of objective truths. But the postmodernist says there is no objective truth. Or if there is, we can never know it. Truth is something we construct. It's constructed by our culture, by our the groups that we're part of, or even by our own individual choices. So now you talk to people, including out in the Arctic Circle of Alaska or out in, you know, rural Mississippi, who say, well, you know, when you talk to them about Christianity or about other things, they say, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. You can't impose your view on anybody else. I have my own beliefs. And they determine their beliefs basically by what they like, by what they want, by their will, by which they construct their own value. And so this idea of relativism, whether it's religious relativism, you know, all religions are equally valid, you know, not even looking at which one might be true, they don't even ask truth questions. It's, well, that's right for you, and somebody else has another, that's right for them. Moral relativism, that we have our own morality, and there is no morality that's valid for everybody. You know, notice the people that believe in abortion, they don't call themselves pro-abortion, they're pro-choice. And that's a good example of a postmodern approach to ethics. Whatever I choose, that's right for me. You can't, if somebody chooses to have a baby, that's fine for her. If they chooses not to have the baby, that's right for that person. And we're seeing this applied in everything, in all kinds of lifestyle issues, sexual practices, the idea that there are no moral absolutes, just like there are no religious absolutes or even intellectual absolutes. That's the essence of postmodernism.
I'm sure in conversations with students, in whether it be at the university in the context of English classes, or whether it be talking to young journalists, or whether it be speaking to seminary students, you run into students who believe in theological and ethical absolutes because they're committed to historic Christianity. They embrace reformational truth, but they get into the area of literature and music, and they are committed, whether they realize it or not, to postmodernism in those areas. That is, they don't believe in making a distinction between high and low culture, or between making sort of absolutist evaluations of literature and music. Get into that conversation with me. Pretend like I'm that student that doesn't believe that you can make cultural evaluations, and talk me out of my position. Talk with me a little bit about how I need to think about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, the old thinkers, the old theologians, the old philosophers, talked about absolutes, and that there were three kinds of absolutes: the true, the good, and the beautiful. Those were the three realms. In other words, truth, the area of knowledge, there is absolute truth, no matter, maybe we don't know what it is, but there is such a thing as absolute truth. The good, goodness, their absolute morality. Whether we live up to it or not, there is absolute morality. But beauty was also an absolute. Aesthetic realm was a realm of absolutes. And what's interesting is that I think really aesthetic relativism is often the starting point for the other kinds of relativism. You're right. Today there are people who, at least in principle, will say there's absolute truth and absolute beauty, but then they're relativists. They throw out aesthetics. Now, the irony is, in the postmodern world, almost everything has become reduced to aesthetics. You take this aesthetic. And again, there's complicated issues of taste, and there are certainly legitimate differences in what in a person's taste. But taste is something that was always seen as something that could mature and grow and become better. But now, aesthetics is used to judge the good, so that people, you know, will either like or dislike a certain moral code. It's applied to intellectual issues. It's applied to religious issues, for sure. So people choose churches according to whether they like that church, not whether they believe in them, what that church is teaching, or that that church is telling them what they need to know. But they choose it for aesthetic reasons. And a lot of churches are sort of going along with that, trying to attract people by, you know, pop music and pop psychology and pop this and that, kind of surrendering to that pop culture and so becoming indistinguishable from it. But I think to recover the good and the true, one way to do that is to get a more biblical foundation of understanding what aesthetic absolutes entail.
What are some of the places that you would point a person to read on that? Because in my feeling for that is that there are very few folks that have done any philosophical thinking or reading about aesthetics. They come to aesthetics through their own personal tastes and feelings, and they sort of, well, this is the way I like, this is what I like, this is what I feel, and they've not done a lot of rigorous thinking, and they may never have had anyone actually in the context of the classroom take them on a vigorous philosophical walk through the issues. Where would be some of the places you'd point them?
Well, Crossway has a series, the Focal Point series, that you mentioned My God at Work is part of that. And before that, there's the Turning Point series that my book Postmodern Times is about. I don't want to feel weird just pushing my own books, but...
Please do, though.
that's what I know. I have a book in the Turning Point series called The State of the Arts,
right?
Which tries to set up a biblical way of looking at the arts. I also have a book called Reading Between the Lines, a Christian Guide to Literature, which tries to help Christians understand literature, and both of those deal with these kind of issues. And
let me pause and just tell the folks about that. Let's pick up first with the one on the arts, State of the Arts, subtitled From Bezalel to Mapplethorpe. The references there for those of you who aren't familiar with Bezalel is Bezalel was the artisan, or one of the artisans, along with Aholiab, who were commissioned to do some of the beautiful design and craftsmanship on the tabernacle, as recorded at the end of the book of Exodus. And of course, Mapplethorpe refers to the infamous modern artist whose exhibits caused some controversy in the late 1990s and in the early 2000s, as they were displayed in various places, and there were many people who pointed out the indecency and the blasphemy and sacrilege that were entailed in some of those displays. So this is State of the Arts by Jean Edward Veith. It's in the Turning Point series, which is part of a Christian Worldview series that Marvin Alasky, who is the editor of World Magazine, spearheaded, and this is a book that would walk you through some of the foundational issues in doing evaluation of aesthetic absolutes in the area of the arts. The other one pertains to literature. It's called Reading Between the Lines, again by Jean Edward Veith, and it's subtitled A Christian Guide to Literature, and it's in this Turning Point Christian Worldview series by Crossway Books. And again, if you go to Good News Crossway on the web, you could Google it and come up with Good News Crossway. There will be a listing of their books, and of course any good bookstore will be able to order from them, and any Christian bookstore. And in our area, whether you go to Lifeway Books or to Reformed Theological Seminary or to the Presbyterian bookstore here at First Pres, where we'll have a lot of these things in stock. Even if those stores don't have these in stock, they'll find it very easy to order them. And of course, you can go to Amazon.com or any other of the many, many online booksellers and find these things. But those are two books that will not only give you some material on which you can do some initial thinking, but they'll also point you to some other literature on this whole area of postmodernism. Ed, talk to us then just a little bit as we're trying to come with some absolutes by which we can evaluate either literature or or art? What are some of the places that we can sort of plant our feet in the ground and get an Archimedean point from which to do evaluation in a culture where everybody thinks it's all relative?
Well, I think, you know, the Bible is obviously the place that we need to start.
Mm.
In that passage where it talks about Bezalel and Oholiab, the scriptures deal directly with some important aesthetic issues.
Mm.
And in terms really of vocation, what we talked about last time, the scripture talks about first how God called Bezalel.
Mm.
That's the first, the word vocation means calling. It's the first time the scripture deals directly with the doctrine of vocation. And then it talks about how God gave him certain gifts.
Hmm.
In order to do the beautiful designs that he intended. And, of course, that in itself shows that God values beauty,
hmm.
design, and that he wanted his tabernacle to be adorned, as it says later, of the garments of the priests, for glory and for beauty.
Hmm.
Again, art properly does glorify
hmm.
God. And it's interesting, for glory, but also for beauty,
hmm.
so that if something's beautiful, that's value in itself.
Mm.
But it talks about how God gave him certain gifts. It gave him the gift of craftsmanship. In other words, the ability to, and the talent to make things well. And so there's a sense in which something can be well made. And of course, the more you know about a craft, whether it's painting or sculpture or music, the mastery of the craft is part of what you need to look for. It talks about how God gave him intelligence.
Hmm.
In other words, there's certain knowledge that is manifest in a really a good work of art. It talks about God gave him ability. In other words, the talent to do something, to make a work of art, whether it's playing a musical instrument or being able to be a good photographer, not everyone can do that. And we're to see the ability of those who do in as a gift from God. And a lot of contemporary art, there's no evident talent. That was required to make it. There, you know, the black canvas,
mm.
or the I read recently there was an art installation that looked exactly like garbage
mm.
set on outside of a building,
mm.
and the garbage collectors didn't realize that it was a work of art, and so they hauled it away. Well, you need to be able to tell the difference.
Mm.
Ruskin. By the way, I did another book called Painters of Faith,
hmm.
which is about the Hudson River School artists, who were the first distinctly American artists, the American School of Artists, and they were Reformed Christians,
hmm.
And they're known for these spectacular scenes of nature,
hmm.
and they were operating out of a very strong Christian understanding, even as they were doing secular subjects, but Ruskin, who is one of the people they were influenced by, talks about how difficult was this to do. In other words, a great work of art often will show difficulty.
Mm.
It may be very simple, and yet there was some talent involved in the making of it.
Mm.
Whereas other things, are so simple. You know, rock and roll number with, you know, three chords.
Right.
That's about all there is to it.
Right.
As opposed to a beautiful, complex orchestration by Bach. You know, there's a real objective difference in the kind of music that is, and in the talent that it took to create it. So those are some things. Ruskin, interestingly enough, and some other theologians have done this too, talks about how beauty and things that we respond to them because they speak to us in somehow of God, who is the source of all beauty. Well, Jonathan Edwards was the great master who developed this. Mm. His writings on aesthetics are fascinating. For example, we tend to find something beautiful if it partakes in some way of infinity. Mm. In other words, these landscapes, like the Hudson River's, or did they just blow us away by their magnificence, and we're just in awe of them? Why does that attract us? Well, because it's a faint little intimation of infinity, which is a quality of God. And so we respond to that. Something that's infinitely small can also fill us with that sense of awe, and that's because it's a pointer to the God who made this vast universe. Of course, God is the ultimate artist. Mm. So the qualities that we see in him and in his work and in how nature operates also resonate with us on this aesthetic level.
People will often argue that our aesthetic values are not rooted in anything transcendent or universal, but are in fact they're just social conventions. You know, they're things that our own culture and society in a narrower sense have created in us or imposed on us, and hence. Ideals like these aesthetic ideals don't transcend culture. They're different from culture to culture. How would you begin to sort of counter-argue?
Well, it's very easily refuted by one simple fact. Do you know who makes up the biggest market for classical music, like Bach and Beethoven and orchestral music?
Probably the Asians.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not Germany, where yeah. these the culture that where many of these great composers work, certainly not the United States, and yet in Japan, particularly, they are wild about this.
Right.
It has nothing to do with their culture, and yet they respond to it in an amazing way. I think our culture has drifted away, so that's maybe preventing us from seeing some of this this great work in an objective way that would help us appreciate it. But the fact is, great art is not culture-bound. Now, there's an interesting study where they took different artifacts and took them to artists or craftsmen of different cultures. In other words, they would take an African tribe and find the tribesman who made the most beautiful, or was acclaimed for making the best weapons or the best pottery, and they did that with different cultures, and then they took different artifacts to let these different artists from different cultures to judge them. And there's amazing unanimity about what was the best, what was the best done. And it seems that great art is specifically that is not culture bound. A lot of our art is the latest popular, top 10 record. You listen to it a few months later, and it sounds old-fashioned, and people get tired of it, and they don't want to hear it, and they're ready for the next top 10 hit, whatever that is. But it often doesn't last. Whereas if you watch a play of Shakespeare, or which is certainly not from our culture, from a culture as alien as any anything could be, where you listen to a Bach chorale, which again is not our culture, people still love it, and it never gets old. I've taught Hamlet hundreds of times, and yet every time I read that play, I see something more in it.
Right.
And you can't do that with kind of the mass-produced pop commercial stuff that dominates people's taste today. Now, the difference is, because there's an objective element to it, you have to know something. In other words, objective knowledge is important as sort of a key to unlock the aesthetic riches.
Mm.
So some people, you know, don't like classical music, but they don't know anything about classical
mm-hmm.
music. And the most challenging and most satisfying works of art require a little bit of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't necessarily take a lot of knowledge, but just a little bit all of a sudden unlocks all of these things, which is why you sometimes have to study these things in school. And
right.
We're working on the Focal Point series for a book on music
mm-hmm.
that's going to do exactly that thing. Just tell people how to listen to music and sort of open it up to them so that they really they'll get far more enjoyment, so even subjective enjoyment out of good music than they will the kind of minimal kind of music that is all people know today.
Do you like Ken Meyer's book in the Turning Point series,
yes.
All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes on this
yes.
issue?
I was going to mention that when you
yeah.
talk about resources. Yes, that's a great book that talks about the difference between pop culture, folk culture, and high culture. And again, pop culture is what's mass-produced. We've talked about high culture a little bit, the work by the great, talented geniuses. There's also folk culture, which also, I think, is very good and very wholesome, and something
mm-hmm.
Christians should get back to.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cultural artifacts that come out of a community, of a people with a history that have roots in the traditions and in the past. Your readers will, or your listeners will appreciate this. I am a huge fan of bluegrass music,
mm-hmm.
and that's an example of a music that is very creative. Great artistry in the people
mm-hmm.
who can, you know, tear through a bluegrass number.
Mm.
And it has roots that go so far back into our history, into our culture, even back before America. Some of those tunes come from Scotland and go all the way back to the Middle
That's
Ages
right.
in some
That's
cases.
Right.
And folk culture is very conservative in that its purpose is to maintain, you know, the values and the identity of a group of people through the ages. And a good way for people, I say, for my students and others who are just, pop culture is the only culture they have.
Mm.
They don't know any other kind
yeah.
of culture. I encourage them to cultivate the folk culture and the high culture.
Mm.
Sometimes the folk culture is a little bit easier
right.
as a starting point. Instead of just listening to the latest rap record, listen to some of these old performers, some of the blues
mm.
artists, and some of the folk artists, some of the country, the old style country artists. And you'll find there's a richer vein, there's deal with deeper kind of subjects
yep.
than typically what you just have on what they're playing on the radio.
Ed, thanks so much for being with us today. I can't believe it. We've come to the end of our hour again. But do check out Ed Veith's work at World Magazine, at the World Mag blog, and at the Chronic Institute, CRANACH.org. And thanks for being with us, Ed. And thanks for listening to us, folks. Have a good Lord's Day.